Chapter 34 Admiral Sandecker stood in front of his desk and held out his hand as Gaskell and Ragsdale were ushered into his office. He gave a friendly smile. "Gentlemen, please take a seat and get comfortable." Gaskell looked down at the little man who stood slightly below his shoulders. "Thank you for taking the time to see us. Numa has worked with Customs and the FBI in the past. Our relations were always based on cordial cooperation. I hope you weren't apprehensive when we asked to meet with you," said Ragsdale. "Curious is more like it. Would you like some coffee?" Gaskell nodded. "Black for me, thank you." "Whatever artificial sweetener that's handy in mine," said Ragsdale. Sandecker spoke into his intercom and then looked up and asked, "Well, gentlemen, what can I do for you?" Ragsdale came straight to the point. "We'd like Numa's help settling a thorny problem dealing with stolen artifacts." "A little out of our line," said Sandecker. "Our field is ocean science and engineering." Gaskell nodded. "We understand, but it has come to Customs attention that someone in your agency has smuggled a valuable artifact into the country illegally." "That someone was me," Sandecker shot back without batting an eye. Ragsdale and Gaskell glanced at each other and shifted uneasily in their chairs. This turn of events was not what they had expected. "Are you aware, Admiral, that the United States prohibits the importing of stolen artifacts under a United Nations convention that seeks to protect antiquities worldwide?"
"I am."
"And are you also aware, sir, that officials at the Ecuadorian embassy have filed a protest?"
"As a matter of fact, I instigated the protest."
Gaskell sighed and visibly relaxed. "I had a feeling in my bones there was more to this than a simple smuggling."
"I think Mr. Gaskell and I would both appreciate an explanation," said Ragsdale.
Sandecker paused as his private secretary, Julie Wolfe, entered with a tray of coffee cups and set them on the edge of his desk.
"Excuse me, Admiral, but Rudy Gunn called from San Felipe to report that he and Al Giardino have landed and are making final preparations for the project."
"What is Dirk's status?"
"He's driving and should be somewhere in Texas about now."
Sandecker turned back to the government agents after Julie had closed the door.
"Sorry for the interruption. Where were we?"
"You were going to tell us why you smuggled a stolen artifact into the United States," said Ragsdale, his face serious. The Admiral casually opened a box of his cigars and offered them. The agents shook their heads. He leaned back in his desk chair, lit a cigar, and graciously blew a cloud of blue smoke over his shoulder toward an open window. Then he told them the story of Drake's Quipu, beginning with the war between the Inca princes and ending with Hiram Yeager's translation of the coiled strands and their knots.
"But surely, Admiral," questioned Ragsdale, "you and Numa don't intend to get into the treasure-hunting business."
"We most certainly do," Sandecker smiled.
"I wish you'd explain the Ecuadorian protest," said Gaskell.
"I wish you'd explain the Ecuadorian protest," said Gaskell. "As insurance. Ecuador is in bitter conflict with an army of peasant rebels in the mountains. Their government officials were not about to allow us to search for the Quipu and then take it to the United States for decoding and preservation, for fear their people would think they had sold a priceless national treasure to foreigners. By claiming we stole it, they're off the hook. So they agreed to loan the Quipu to Numa for a year, and when we return it with the proper ceremony, they'll be applauded as national heroes."
"But why Numa?" Ragsdale persisted. "Why not the Smithsonian or National Geographic?"
"Because we don't have a proprietary interest, and we're in a better position to keep the search and discovery out of the public eye."
"But you can't legally keep any of it." Of course not. If it's discovered in the Sea of Cortez, where we believe it lies, Mexico will cry finders keepers. Peru will claim original ownership, and the two countries will have to negotiate, thereby assuring the treasures will eventually be displayed in their national museums. And our State Department will get credit for a public relations coup with our good neighbors to the south, added Bragsdale. You said it, sir, not me. Why didn't you notify Customs or the FBI about this? Inquired Gaskell. I informed the President, Sandecker replied matter-of-factly. If he failed to filter the information from the White House to your agencies, then you'll just have to blame the White House. Ragsdale finished his coffee and set the cup on the tray. You've closed the door on one problem that concerned us all, Admiral. And believe me when I say we are extremely relieved at not having to put you through the hassle of an investigation. Unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your viewpoint, you've opened the door to another dilemma. Gaskell looked at Ragsdale. The coincidence is nothing short of astonishing. Coincidence? Sandecker asked, curiously. That after almost 500 years, two vital clues to the mystery of Huascar's treasure surfaced from two different sources within 5 days of each other. Sandecker shrugged. I'm afraid I don't follow you. In turn, Gaskell filled the Admiral in on the golden bodysuit of Tiapoyo. He finished by giving a brief summary of the case against Xolar International. Are you telling me that another party is searching for Huascar's treasure at this very minute? Sandecker asked incredulously. Ragsdale nodded. An international syndicate that deals in art theft, antiquity smuggling, and art forgery, with annual profits running into untold millions of untaxed dollars. I had no idea. Regrettably, our government and news media have not seen the benefit in educating the general public on a criminal activity that is second only to the drug trade. In one robbery alone, explained Gaskell, the dollar estimate of the masterpieces stolen from the Gardner Museum in Boston in April 1990 came to $200 million. When you throw in the combined theft, smuggling, and forgery operations taking place in nearly every country of the world, Ragsdale continued, you can understand why we're looking at a billion-dollar industry. The list of art and antiquities stolen over the past 100 years would equal the number of names in the New York phone book, Gaskell emphasized. Who buys such a staggering amount of illegal goods? Asked Sandecker. The demand far exceeds the supply, answered Gaskell. Wealthy collectors are indirectly responsible for looting because they create a strong market demand. They stand in line to purchase historically significant hot goods from underground dealers. The list of clients reads like a celebrity register. Heads of state, high-level government officials, motion picture personalities, top business leaders, and even curators of major museums who look the other way while negotiating for black market goods to enhance their collections. If they have a buck, they'll buy it. Drug dealers also buy untold amounts of illegal art and antiquities as a fast and easy way of laundering money while building an investment. I can see why unrecorded artifacts are lost in the shuffle, said Sandecker. But surely famous art paintings and sculptures turn up and are recovered. Ragsdale shook his head. Sometimes we get lucky and a tip leads us to stolen property. Occasionally, honest art dealers or museum curators will call us when they recognize pieces the thieves are trying to sell. All too often, missing art remains lost from lack of leads. A tremendous number of antiquities obtained by grave robbers are sold before archaeologists have a chance to study them, Gaskell said. For example, during the Desert War against Iraq in the early 90s, thousands of artifacts, including untranslated clay tablets, jewelry, textiles, glass, pottery, gold and silver coins, and cylinder seals, were plundered from both Kuwaiti and Iraqi museums by anti-Hussein opposition forces and Shiite and Kurdish rebels. Much of it had already passed through dealers and auction houses before any of the pieces could be catalogued as missing or stolen. Hardly seems possible that a collector would pay big money for art he knows damn well belongs to someone else, said Sandecker. He certainly can't put it on display without risking exposure or arrest. What does he do with it? Call it a psychological warp, replied Ragsdale. Gaskell and I can recite any number of cases involving collectors who stash their illegal acquisitions in a secret vault where they sit and view it once a day, or maybe once every 10 years. Never mind that none of it is on public display. They get their high by possessing something no one else can own. Gaskell nodded in agreement. Collector addiction can make people carry out macabre schemes. It's bad enough to desecrate and despoil Indian graves by digging up and selling skulls and mummified bodies of women and children. But certain collectors of American Civil War memorabilia have gone so far as to dig up graves in national cemeteries just to retrieve Union and Confederate belt buckles. A sad commentary on avarice, mused Sandecker. The stories of grave plundering for artifacts are endless, said Ragsdale. Bones of the dead from every culture, beginning with the Neanderthal, are smashed and scattered. The sanctity of the dead means little if there is a profit to be made. Because of the many collectors' insatiable lust for antiquities, said Gaskell, they're prime candidates for rip-offs. Their seemingly inexhaustible demand creates a lucrative trade in forgeries. Ragsdale nodded. Without proper archaeological study, copied artifacts can pass undetected. Many of the collections in respected museums display forged antiquities, and no one realizes. Every curator or collector is unwilling to believe he has been screwed by a forger, and few scholars have the guts to state that the pieces they are examining are suspect. Famous art is not exempt, Gaskell further explained. Agent Ragsdale and I have both seen cases where an outstanding masterpiece was stolen, copied by experts, and the forgery returned through channels for the finder's fee and insurance. The gallery and its curator happily hang the fake, never realizing they've been had. How are the stolen objects distributed and sold? Queried Sandecker. Tomb looters and art thieves sell through an underground network of crooked dealers, who put up the money and supervise the sales from a distance, acting through agents without revealing their identity. Can't they be traced through the network? Gaskell shook his head. Because the suppliers and their distributors also operate behind closed doors under a heavy veil of secrecy, it is next to impossible for us to penetrate any particular branch of the network with any prospect of following a trail to the top dealers. Ragsdale took over. It's not like tracing a drug user to his street corner dealer, and then to his suppliers, and then up the ladder to the drug lords, who are mostly uneducated, seldom go to extremes to hide their identities, and are often drug users themselves. Instead, we find ourselves matching wits with men who are well-educated and highly connected in the top levels of business and government. They're shrewd and they're cunning. Except in rare cases, they never deal with their clients on a direct face-to-face basis. Whenever we get close, they pull into their shells and throw up a wall of expensive attorneys to block our investigations. Have you had any luck at all? Asked Sandecker. We've picked off a few of the small dealers who operate on their own, replied Ragsdale. And both our agencies have recovered substantial numbers of stolen goods. Some during shipment, some from buyers, who almost never do jail time because they claim they didn't know the pieces they bought were stolen. What we've recovered is only a trickle. Without solid evidence, we can't stem the main flow of illegal objects. Sounds to me like you fellows are outgunned and outclassed, said Sandecker. Ragsdale nodded. We'd be the first to admit it. Sandecker silently rocked back and forth in his swivel chair, mulling over the words of the government agent seated across the desk. At last he said, "How can Numa help you?" Gaskell leaned across the desk. "We think you cracked the door open by unknowingly synchronizing your search for Waskar's treasure with the world's largest dealer of hot art and antiquities, Zolar International. Yes, a family whose tentacles reach into every corner of the trade. FBI and customs agents," said Ragsdale, "have never before encountered a single group of art forgers, thieves, and artifact smugglers who have operated in so many countries for so many years and have involved such a diverse cast of wealthy celebrities who have illegally bought literally billions of dollars worth of stolen art and antiques." "I'm listening," said Sandecker. "This is our chance to get in on the ground floor," revealed Gaskell. "Because of the possibility of finding fantastic riches, the Zolars have shed all caution and launched a search to locate the treasure and keep it for themselves. If they are successful, this presents us with a rare window of opportunity to observe their method of shipment and trail it back to their secret storehouse." "Where you nab them red-handed with the swag," Sandecker finished. Ragsdale grinned. "We don't exactly use those terms anymore, Admiral, but yes, you're on the right track." Sandecker was intrigued. "You want me to call off my search team, is that the message?" Gaskell and Ragsdale looked at each other and nodded. "Yes, sir," said Gaskell. "That's the message." "With your approval, of course," Ragsdale hastily added. "Have you boys cleared this with your superiors?" Ragsdale nodded solemnly. "Director Moran of the FBI and Director Thomas of the Customs Service have given their approval." "You don't mind if I give them a call and confirm?" "Not at all," said Gaskell. "I apologize that Agent Ragsdale and I didn't go through the chain of command and request that they deal with you directly, but we felt it was best to present our case from first-hand knowledge and let the chips fall where they may." "I can appreciate that," said Sandecker generously. "Then you'll cooperate," asked Ragsdale, "and call off your search team?" Sandecker stared idly at the smoke curling from his cigar for several moments. "Numa will play ball with the Bureau and Customs, but I won't close down our search project." Gaskell stared at the Admiral, not knowing if he was joking. "I don't think I catch your drift, sir." "Have you people ever hunted for something that has been lost for almost 500 years? Ragsdale glanced at his partner and shrugged. "Speaking for the Bureau, our search operations are generally confined to missing persons, fugitives, and bodies. Lost treasure is out of our domain." "I don't believe I have to explain what the Customs Service looks for," said Gaskell. "I'm quite familiar with your directives," Sandecker said conversationally. "But finding lost treasure is a million-to-one long shot. You can't interview people for leads who have been dead since the 1500s. All our quipu and your golden mummy have done is give vague references to a mysterious island in the Sea of Cortez. A clue that puts the proverbial needle somewhere within 160,000 square kilometer haystack. I'm assuming the Zolars are amateurs at this kind of search game. So the chances of them finding the cavern containing Waskar's golden chain are 10 meters this side of nil." "You think your people have a better chance?" asked Gaskell testily. "My special projects director and his team are the best in the business. If you don't believe me, check our records." "How do you plan to play ball with us?" Ragsdale asked, his tone edged with disbelief. Sandecker made his thrust. "We conduct our search at the same time as the Zolars, but we hang in the shadows. They have no reason to suspect rivals, and will assume any Numa personnel or aircraft they sight are on an oceanographic research project. If the Zolars are successful in discovering the treasure, my team will simply melt away and return to Washington.
And should the Zolars strike out? Demanded Ragsdale.
If Numa can't find the treasure, it doesn't want to be found.
And if Numa is successful, Ragsdale pushed forward.
We leave a trail of breadcrumbs for the Zolars to follow, and let them think they discovered the hoard on their own.
Sandecker paused, his hard gaze moving from Ragsdale to Gaskell and back.
From then on, gentlemen, the show belongs to you.